You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. My guests today are Mark and Cora Logic. They were among the six American diplomats who hid out in the home of a Canadian diplomat at the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. They would be rescued in an operation led by CIA officer Tony Mendez and smuggled out by way of the airport in Tehran. An interview with Tony Mendez we did on the 2nd of September, 2008. Today, we will have an opportunity to interview both Mark and Cora Logic, as well as Tony Mendez, who has joined us. So, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you give us just a sense of the atmospherics in those days, that little period leading up to the actual takeover of the embassy?
I was in Tehran for about 3 months prior to the takeover. It was chaotic. The government had basically collapsed. It was dangerous to, especially for Westerners, to travel around the city in the evenings. As I learned shortly after my arrival, there were roadblocks at night, and diplomatic status did not mean anything to the comités, the revolutionary committees that manned these roadblocks. On the plus side, there was a esprit de corps within the diplomatic community. People still managed to have fun and get together despite the obstacles. And essentially, it was the real concern I had was I was okay there myself, but I really didn't want my wife to join me, which had been the plan, because I realized that Washington fundamentally misunderstood what was going on in Iran. They thought that the official government actually controlled something, and it was pretty obvious to everyone on the ground that they didn't, that talking to President Bazargan or Prime Minister Bazargan was essentially equivalent to talking to ourselves, because he didn't run anything. And the embassy, the political people, were trying to make that point to Washington, but not successfully.
Now, you were a consular officer in the American Embassy.
Yes.
And Cora, you were a working wife, in effect, in the consular section.
Right.
Did you, clearly you experienced some apprehension about being in the street, as it were. Did it ever occur to anyone that something like a takeover of the embassy could occur?
Well, you might recall the embassy actually was taken Valentine's Day that same year. So I don't think, you know, it was something that was out of possibility. However, when it did occur, I think we all thought it would be the same. It would be held for 24 hours and everybody would be released, because that's what had happened in February.
And you were out of the embassy at the time, or did you flee the embassy?
We were working at least I was working, the consular section was closed because the chargé was at the foreign ministry to protest our walls having been defaced yet again with "Down with the Carter" and "Death to America" kind of graffiti, and he closed the visa unit in protest, but the rest of us were open. Had a few people in the waiting room, and we were in a separate building from the chancery, some distance away. And for whatever reason, the militants, when they stormed the compound, focused only on the chancery for the initial hour or so. And by the time they got around to us, I'd say maybe an hour had passed, and we were already thinking about what to do and where to go. Initially, we were told to march over in a group to the chancery, which seemed rather stupid, and no one was interested in that option. But then they said, they told us to go to the British Embassy, which was the standard operating procedure, that we would go there. So we left our building ultimately after about, I'd say about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, through the door that visa applicants used to enter. It opened onto a back alley, and we took a left turn in the direction of the British Embassy, and the rest of the Americans there went a different route. They decided to ignore the British, or the order to go to the British, and went instead toward the home of the Consul General, and they got arrested within a couple minutes, and we managed to get lost in the crowds, and eventually we didn't make it to the British Embassy because of a demonstration, but we did make it to the apartment of Bob Anders, one of the people in our group, and from there we moved numerous times until we reached the Canadians.
Now, when you say we, you're talking about you and Cora at this point.
Well, no, there were, in addition, Joe and Kathy Stafford and Bob Anders, so there were five of us in the group that we weren't always together all the time, but we made it to the Canadians as a group.
Now, you ended up in the home of a Canadian consular officer, John Sheridan.
That's correct.
How did you happen to end up in his home in particular?
Well, Bob Anders and John Sheridan were friends, and after we had been on the run for a couple of days, had been hosted by the British and then put back on the street because of their security problems, their legitimate security problems, I should add, we were staying in an embassy-leased residence that we felt wasn't secure, at one point, Bob decided to explore the possibility of help from John. He called him, and John's response was, "Well, why didn't you call sooner?" And Bob said, "Well, I'm not by myself. I have other people with me." And John said, "That's no problem. Bring them all." And we were, of course, very gratified by that response, but we didn't really want to impose our problems on the Canadians, so we didn't take immediate advantage of it. But I think, within about 2 days, it became obvious we didn't have a choice, and so we called. Bob called John again, and John contacted the British because they knew where we were hiding, having taken us there, and they came and got us and took us over to John's.
Cora, did you feel safe there?
At John's house?
Yes.
Definitely. It was a very private house. There was a wall around it, which was very common in northern Tehran, just the way most of the homes are. And I don't think anything inside the house was visible from the neighbors' houses. Where the last house we had been at, the kitchen was right on the kitchen window was right on the street. The back of the house had a window that went floor to ceiling. And this was a house of someone who was a hostage. So the house had been empty for several days and no power, and all of a sudden here we are in there, and we figure neighbors are going to see lights on and they probably would call someone. So we're very happy to reach John's house, very safe house, and the layout was really a perfect place to hide.
Were you apprehensive at the time that the folks taking over the embassy would simply be hunting for any other Americans in the area?
Well, I knew that the embassy maintained the records of all the leased houses, and I figured it was only a matter of time before they started going through them. And I had been making that argument to others in our group that, you know, we really couldn't count on safety in any house that was connected officially to the embassy. But again, options were limited. So we tried to stay in that house. Initially the house of the public affairs officer, and then the house of the woman who was in charge of the cultural center. Our host was a Thai fellow who had worked for the our number two guy, Victor Tomseth, and they were able to communicate in Thai. Victor was being held at I guess he was a guest of the foreign ministry, but he was able to use the phone. And he is actually the one who arranged for us to use these homes. But like I said, it was fairly clear that despite Sam's best efforts, the Thai gentleman, things were not going to be viable for the long term there.
How long were you there before you finally the escape was arranged? How long did you actually spend there?
About 3 months total.
Three months. Yeah, can you just give a sense? I know we can't go day to day, but just give a sense. What was that like?
Well, we kind of fell into a routine fairly quickly. John Sheerdown would go to work every day, and Zena, his wife, was at home with us. And they actually also had a Filipino woman working for them, Lolita. They pretty much left us on our own during the day, and then at night when John would come home, we'd all sit down and have a formal dinner, and he would tell us the news, what had happened during the day, if there was anything going on with the hostages. We were able to watch news on TV for a while, but I think the television broke. It seems like at some point he was only our only source of information. And while we were there at Thanksgiving and Christmas, and John and Zena did an amazing job trying to make us feel very welcome and at home. John managed to get a turkey somewhere for Thanksgiving. And at Christmas, there were a few other diplomats that knew about us, and he invited those folks over for Christmas. And it was, you know, considering the situation, it actually was a very memorable Christmas. They really made us feel very comfortable.
Let me just ask you, for that whole time you were in the house, which was something on the order of 3 months, did you have concerns? Was there anything happening or you were concerned about that would cause the information about your presence there to leak out?
John and Zena had a gardener who belonged to the local comité. Each neighborhood had a local committee who guarded the area, kind of checked who came in and out of the neighborhood. And so John felt he couldn't fire him, but on the other hand, we didn't want him to see us and suddenly say, why are these four people in this house? Who are they? So we actually took shoe polish and we put it on the windows in the kitchen, so if he were walking by, he wouldn't see us. It'd be kind of blurred. And as far as I know, I don't think we ever were seen by him.
The other issues came later, really, when the owner of the home that John was renting decided to sell it, and all of a sudden buyers were coming and we had to leave the house. I think three or four times Roger Lucy would come and get us and take us to his apartment, but we couldn't we were not used to being outside, so just going out of the house was a source of paranoia. And nothing bad ever happened, but we just felt very exposed. And there were some other logistical problems for John, the biggest one being taking care of garbage, because there were obviously four people, especially six people, as when there had been only two. A lot more garbage, a lot more empty liquor bottles to get rid of, and that in particular was something that was sensitive in Tehran at the time. So John was very inventive. He'd take the garbage to work with him, and I think he told us he was dumping it in front of the local comité at like 5 a.m. when nobody was around, just tossing it out his car window as he drove by. So we coped.
There was that one other incident I just remembered. At Christmas time, I decided to make Christmas cookies. And the kitchen counters were just covered with these cookies. And a secretary from the Canadian Embassy, a local lady who didn't know about us, came by the house for some reason. So we had to go into hiding. And she ended up in the kitchen. And she looked around and she says, "Zena, is this what you do all the time? You make cookies?" And Zena, she bakes now, but back then she really wasn't a cookie baker, but she had to pretend she'd made all these cookies. So that was pretty funny.
Well, the secret was kept, so you were successful. When Tony arrived on the scene, had you had any warning, or was that a bolt out of the blue, so to speak?
Well, we had started making noises to the Canadians that we thought our situation needed to be addressed separately from that of the hostages, that we had been told there was a plan to escort the six of us to the airport in the event that the release of the hostages were somehow negotiated, and we were supposed to kind of just show up at the last minute in this convoy with half a dozen Western ambassadors escorting us and be presented to the Iranians, and the Iranians would somehow magically agree to let us depart with the others. And we thought that was not a good idea, that more than likely it would cause the whole deal to explode, and that we, as since we hadn't been captured or interrogated, we obviously were the CIA people because we got out. So there was, to me, it just seemed like a really dumb idea, and to be blunt. In early February, we asked, Bob Anders and I drafted a cable. We asked Ken Taylor, Ambassador Taylor, to send through his channels to the State Department, basically saying the things that I've just outlined in more polite language, but basically to the effect that there needed to be a plan to get us out of Iran because our continued presence was, with each passing day, the likelihood of something going wrong, Murphy's Law, you know, we're going to get caught somehow. The Canadians were exposing themselves to ever greater risk, and so the message was never formally transmitted, but I do think that Ambassador Taylor made it, did pass on the gist of our feelings. And I think also there were people in Washington who had similar views that we needed to, perhaps Tony, I'm not sure, but I think there was a sense that our problem was separate and it needed to be addressed sooner rather than later.
Ambassador Taylor, of course, was the Canadian ambassador who performed quite courageously during this period and sort of enabled a number of you to stay in hiding.
Yes.
Tell us or share with us the arrival of Tony. I'll just put it that way.
Well, you tell this story better than I do, Cora, but we were getting ready for dinner, I think. Mm-hmm. We'd been told there was going to be a special guest.
Right.
Yeah.
My memory, unfortunately, is not so great, but there were two gentlemen who came to dinner. One of them was Tony, and I don't think a lot was said during the dinner, but afterwards...
Do you have any idea who they were?
I'm trying to remember. Did they tell us? Or did we think they were Canadians? I don't recall, actually.
You know, I honestly don't recall now either, but I think we were told ahead of time by Ken that a plan had been put in motion to get us out, and that people would be coming. This was probably about 5 days prior. And so we were getting a little excited about the prospect. And then when Tony actually he came with another individual, and it, as I recall, about dinner time, and we all sat down and had a good meal. We were practicing at that point what we called the scorched earth policy, which was to try to completely consume all the liquor and wine and basically everything that was worth consuming before we left. And since we already had at that point a sense of how long that would be, we were felt a little freer to attack John's store. By this time, I should mention, the Sheardowns had been evacuated, so we were at that point, our babysitter was Roger Lucy, who's the head of Chancery, I guess the chief political officer in our terminology, and we also had some other guests at this dinner. I remember the Danish ambassador was there, Troels Munk, and a few other people. And it was more of a social event than anything else. I think the idea was to get us relaxed and to get to know Tony. And Tony was telling us war stories about how he had extricated people from far worse situations than ours, and how the Iranians were not really in the same league as, say, the Soviets as far as border security, and that was important to us.
So at some point it must have dawned on you, or Tony said, and we can check with him later, that the purpose of his visit was to help, in effect, smuggle you out of Iran, or sometimes we say getting people out black in the operations side. How did that sound to you?
Well, we were very happy with the idea of leaving, and as I recall, those of us who would be leaving went to the den where we spent the day with Tony and the other gentlemen, and Tony told us about several scenarios of ways to get us out, and one was that we were unemployed teachers, I think, and had come back to Tehran, but the international school was closed, so that didn't make any sense, and something else was about a businessman. And Tony really sold us on the Hollywood story because, as Mark said at the time, who'd be crazy enough to come to revolutionary Iran? Well, people from Hollywood, you know, they wouldn't think anything of it. But also Tony had an amazing background, and he told us if we got stopped and there was a phone call to Hollywood, there was a person who would answer the phone and say, yes, we are making a movie. Yes, Teresa Harris and, you know, all the different names are involved in this movie. And they'd actually even put an ad for the movie in Variety. I mean, there was an amazing reality, I mean, not reality, but regalia, maybe you'd call it, out there, and the story would hold. And I think we were just really amazed at that. And Tony really got our confidence in convincing us to do that scenario.
So you, in effect, and I think I recall this from our interview with Tony, began preparing for this exit, and you were being trained, in effect, or coached, let's put it that way, to take on the persona of an advance party for a film. What was that like, and were you scared?
The training part was actually pretty interesting. They gave us information like our new birthdays and our new names, and whoever put that information together did a really good job because Mark had my father's birthday but his year, so it was something I couldn't forget, and a lot of the information was like that, things I already knew. And I thought, you know, since we were amateurs particularly, that, and I don't know if that was true for everybody, I'm assuming it was, but I think Mark had my dad's first name and middle name.
Right.
So, you know, things if I got questioned, no problem. So I felt really comfortable with those things. So we did do a little interrogation with some other diplomats who were helping us.
Roger, in particular, was, Roger is a history buff, and he wore his Nazi German trench coat and sat down as the chief interrogator and barked out the questions and trying to put as much pressure on us to respond quickly, you know, and did a good job. It was, and he did it in a fun way. I mean, it was, we didn't get too wrapped up in it, but at the same time, we all knew it was pretty serious and we wanted to do a good job, but you have to keep your sense of humor. I mean, at least I think it was important, and he helped that, and Tony helped that. It was, considering what we were about to do, I think the attitude was pretty relaxed, and that was important.
I'm trying to, may I just ask you, what was your ostensible role in this advance party? What is it that you were doing for the film?
I was the writer of the script.
You were the writer, and you felt you could carry that off?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. How about you, Mark?
I was the transportation coordinator, and I'm not sure how many questions I could have answered, but the basic thing seemed fairly straightforward to me, that especially if you're going to shoot at Persepolis, which I believe was what we were planning, if I remember correctly, the logistics of getting there and supporting all these Hollywood prima donnas and so forth would be considerable. So bringing somebody like me along made a lot of sense, and I wouldn't have thought that I would be, that my presence would have been viewed by anyone with any knowledge of filmmaking as exceptional, so I didn't worry too much about the details.
Okay, so you weren't the one with your shirt unbuttoned down to the waist and wearing a gold medallion.
No, that was Bob Anders. He was, okay. Was he going to be the, I think the director for that area or something, however, I forget the terminology now, but Bob decided that he was going to be a little flamboyant, shall we say.
Okay, but I think it goes along with the roles that you were playing as right. An advance party for a Hollywood production. So we take you up to the, was it a morning departure? Was it one morning that you then made your way to the airport?
It was in the morning. They brought some embassy vehicles, and as we left the house, we immediately went into our roles because the drivers, of course, didn't know who we were. And so I think there was some talk about the movie, and they're telling us good luck on our project, and then headed off to the airport.
Yeah, I should note that we had had about an hour and a half of sleep. We had a big farewell party the night before, and we truly did finish off the rest of the booze.
So okay.
There was a little concern we might smell like alcohol a bit much, but I tried to brush my teeth about four times to get rid of that. But we only slept for an hour and a half, but we kind of liked that. We were operating on adrenaline. There was no doubt about it, and but it seemed the way to go.
Well, that was showtime, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So what we'll do is we'll leave our listeners here, and we will do another SpyCast with both of you and with Tony. So thank you so much for sharing this part of your experience, which was truly quite extraordinary.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.